There is no shortage of people who want to tell us how to eat or to tell farmers how to farm. The food movement is growing in size and in influence, and it's already having an impact on public policy. What are the consequences of disagreements between members of the food movement and the traditional farm community? And can they find common ground? Well-known food and ag economist Dr. Jason Lusk helps us sort through it all today on Town Hall Ohio.
This is Town Hall Ohio, home to interesting people, engaging issues, and enlightening stories. Town Hall Ohio is a production of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation, working to forge a partnership between farmers and consumers, and is supported by Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Now, here's Town Hall Ohio host, Joe Corneli.
Jason Lusk is a food and agricultural economist who studies what we eat and why we eat it. He's published more than 190 articles in peer-reviewed scientific journals. He served on the editorial councils of numerous economic journals. He is a consultant to nonprofits, government agencies, and agribusinesses. And Dr. Lusk has appeared in and on media outlets such as the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Fox and Friends, The John Stossel Show, and Wall Street Journal Live. His full-time day job is distinguished professor and head of the Department of Agricultural Economics at Purdue University. Jason Lusk, welcome to Town Hall, Ohio.
Thanks for having me on.
You may not remember, you and I met once, oh gosh, 7-8 years ago, you were in Columbus for a session. I stuck a microphone in your face, so I appreciate you not letting me scare you off that first time.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you having me back on.
So as a starting point, before we get into some specifics on a new paper you've issued, give us your assessment of the nation's food system as a whole. Is what we have working for consumers? Is it working for farmers?
Well, it's certainly working for a lot of consumers and a lot of farmers. I think when I get asked a question like that, it's useful for me to take a big step back and look at it from the historical perspective, because nothing's perfect. There's going to be farmers who wish, we all wished, were making a little more money. There's going to be consumers that we wished were better fed. But I think in the historical context, we have one of the greatest food systems that's ever existed in the historical grand scheme of things. You know, throughout most of human history, the biggest concern is whether we're going to have enough food to eat. And that's been the leading concern of intellectuals for the past 200-300 years. And, now that consumers, by and large, are relatively well-fed and we have, you know, more abundant, more nutritious, more affordable food supply than we've really ever had in human history, it's kind of ironic in some ways that many members of the food movement are saying that we live in a broken food system. It is a system that has some challenges. It's a system that we can think about improving. But in a lot of ways, it's a system that has really risen to the challenge that was the concern of history's leading intellectuals. So, there's some things we wish were better. But overall, you know, my sense of the food system is that it's done a lot of good, and it's really a lot better food system than at any other time in our history.
So the discontent that you touch on there, that, yeah, it's good, but is it oversimplifying it to say the much of the debate has shifted from quantity to quality?
I think that's actually a fairly accurate assessment. And one way to kind of think about it is this old idea of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, and you have to start out at the bottom and worry about whether you have enough food to eat and whether you have a shelter over your head. And then once you have those needs met, you can sort of move up and start worrying about other things and eventually progress up onto the top where you try to, you know, worry about things like self-actualization and whether other people like you. Food kind of works the same way. And once you have enough to eat and you can afford to eat, then you can afford to worry about other things and demand more out of the food system. So in some ways, the successes we've had in modern agriculture and bringing down the cost of food and being more productive have in some ways led to the ability of people to ask for more out of the food system. And I think you're right, it is an increasing demand for quality. And that quality we can kind of put in quotes, because what quality means changes over time, and sometimes it's at the whim of fads and what consumers are thinking, but I think a lot of what consumers are asking for can broadly be put under that umbrella of increasing demand for quality.
One of the things that I've noticed, and maybe you could comment on, much of the discord from the farm community side of things, and that's the space I live in most of the time, but there's this picture of people who want things out of their food supply but don't have any practical knowledge of what it takes to grow food. Is that actually a part of why we seem to have a little bit of discontent in the food system?
I certainly think that's at the heart of it. It is, there's a lot of romantic idealism about agricultural production, and there's a lot of marketing surrounding that idea. It's interesting to compare that across countries. When you go to developing countries, for example, like China, and you go in one of their grocery stores, you know, what are they? The images they show are of, say, animal production in highly clean, you know, factory-like environments, because they're wanting to emphasize that this stuff is safe. Whereas here, you know, when we go in a grocery store, what are the stores and marketers trying to do? It's almost like they're wanting to convince us there's a little bit of dirt on it. They're selling us a sort of ideal of pastoralism or a romantic traditionalism. And I think the sort of ideal of this 1940s era agriculture, when confronted with the reality of a modern commercial farming operation, is, I think, at the heart of all this discord. And people wish things were the way they have it in their mind, and often aren't willing to pay, or they think that it should, you know, that they should be able to have the same high quantity of food that they have today, but have it look like it did in the past. And I think that's really a part of the disconnect. Consumers want to have their cake and eat it too. Farmers on the ground are having to deal with the realities of producing enough to make a dollar and compete in a world global marketplace with international trade and in competition with producers across the country and across other countries. And to do that, you've got to be highly efficient and use new technologies. And so I think that disconnect is really at the heart of a lot of this.
We are chatting today with Dr. Jason Lusk. He's distinguished professor and head of the Department of Agricultural Economics at Purdue University. Jason, we've said the consumers, or I think we've used, you and I both have used the term, the food movement. Let's back up a step. Who makes up today's modern food movement?
The word food movement is an umbrella term that relates to a diverse mix of people and organizations, non-government organizations, nonprofits. And you know, whether somebody says they're a part of the food movement or not, it kind of remains to be seen, but it's a blanket term. And it involves also, I'd say, a whole host of food journalists and mainstream journalists that write about food. And largely, these are people that are critical of our modern food production system. They're worried about environmental impacts of agricultural production. They're worried about the health consequences of our current food system. And often they're advocating for a set of food systems and policies that promote things like organic food, local food, more regional food systems, less use of fossil fuels, smaller farms, and a whole set of issues around that. But, you know, it's not like there's a food movement association that you sign up for and we know you're a member of the association. Rather, it's sort of a generic term that gets used sometimes by people within the movement, but sometimes by people outside of it to talk about the groups of people working around these sets of issues.
Yeah, and one of the things I find unique, you mentioned, you know, many of the people under this umbrella have specific concerns about farming practices or the technology perhaps that goes into food, but many of this umbrella under this umbrella also seem to have related issues. You mentioned the environment. For some, it's social justice. Food as a mechanism to influence much of what happens in our community, not just what we put on our plate.
Oh, that's certainly true. It's bundled in together with a whole host of other political issues and causes. And, you know, animal welfare is another one. And so what you'll find are groups sometimes coming together under that umbrella, but they sometimes have very divergent, diverse interests, so they may not always agree on every particular point. But I think you're right. You know, I hate to subscribe, the movement to a particular political party, because it is very diverse, but I'd say it is a movement that's largely skeptical of business involvement in agriculture, so tends to be anti-corporate. tends to be skeptical of anything coming out of corporations, and also tends to be a movement that is very much in favor of a heavier hand of the government to generate a food system that they'd like to see. And so again, I suspect you'd find people of all political stripes under that umbrella, depending on the particular issue we're talking about.
Who would be the traditional food community? Before we had to worry about what other people thought, all we had to worry about was putting food on people's plates. Who do you consider to be in that conventional or old school or traditional community? Farmers, of course, but who else?
Well, frankly, probably still most of us. the reality of a lot of these discussions is the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and so I think that's probably been one of my concerns, is that particularly when we're talking about public policy, let's make sure that whatever policies we're pursuing, that most consumers are going to actually desire the outcomes that result from them. And in a lot of cases, the kinds of food systems that I talked about before they're advocated by the food movement are going to be of the sort that are going to maybe increase quality in one dimension, although that's debatable depending on the topic we're talking about, but almost certainly in every case going to increase the price of food. And so I think that's one overarching lesson that I've tried to get across to people, is that let's make sure that we don't have one set of people that are fairly well-fed advocating for a set of policies that are going to increase food prices for everybody else. So I think most people go about their daily lives, probably don't think about these issues all that much, largely are responding to things like changes in food prices that affect their food budget, occasionally jumping in on a food diet or paying attention to a food quality issue. But I think, more to your question, I think the traditional in terms of the politics of these movements has been the farm community that dictated a lot of farm and food policy. Over time, things, that often became under the umbrella of the USDA dealt with things like adulteration or what have you. And then at some point, probably in the, during the 1960s and so or so, the SNAP food stamp program that came about started playing a larger and larger role in terms of USDA budget, and also captured a lot more attention. And you can go back to writings from the 1980s or so, where you can see thinkers like, one of my predecessors here at Purdue, Don Parlberg, for example, who was Assistant Undersecretary for Ag. He was writing in the 1980s about the coming consumer movements, and what he was noticing was there are all these environmental movements. So think Ralph Nader and those movements, and the sort of anti-hunger movements that were focused on things like SNAP, that were sort of really in their early stages in the 1970s and 80s, and are really, I think, just even today coming to their full maturation. But one way to think about the farm bill and farm discussions over the past 40 or 50 years is it's sort of a compromise between urban legislators that are advocating for things like anti-hunger and food stamps, that can have a coalition with more rural legislators that are worried about farming communities and farm supports, and that sort of political balance has maintained the farm bill over the last 30 or 40 years. And you can see the sort of cantankerous nature of those debates over the last couple of years and how long it took to pass the last farm bill as an evidence that maybe some of that coalition is sort of breaking down, or that there are many more diverse voices in that discussion today than there was in the past, that makes it harder to reach.
We'll have more with Dr. Jason Lusk right after this.
So let's leave it alone, 'cause we can't see eye to eye. There ain't no good guy, there ain't no bad guy, there's only you and me, and we just disagree.
There is disagreement in the food community between some new views and old views, and we're exploring what those are, and hopefully we'll talk about the ability to find some common ground as the show moves forward. Our guest today is distinguished professor and head of the Department of Ag Economics at Purdue University, Dr. Jason Lusk. Dr. Lusk, we were talking about the food movement and who makes it up. It seems to me that just within the past probably 10 to 15 years, That food movement, the people who care immensely and want to have influence on their food supply, it seems to be gaining traction. Would you agree, and to what would you attribute that?
Well, certainly I think it is gaining traction, and, you know, it's hard to pinpoint the origins of these things because they do go back a long way. But for, in my mind, some of the more recent landmarks were popular books by people like Michael Pollan, who wrote Omnivore's Dilemma. That was in 2004. And then, you know, around the same time, a little bit earlier, we had Fast Food Nation, which was another book very critical in that case of fast food, but also food production. And those ideas matter, I think, and they impact cultures, particularly when they're best-selling. And they're books that have been widely adopted and used on college campuses and when kids come to college. And we as professors have a great opportunity to try to educate them and teach them ways of thinking about the world at an impressionable stage. And so, you know, we're now 10, 15 years out from those activities, and so we've got a whole new set of consumers that are more skeptical of the food system. And those are just some of the early beginnings. But, you know, I think part of it goes back to what I mentioned earlier, which is that we continue to find ways to be more productive in agriculture. And the great part of that is that it's more sustainable. If we can produce more food using fewer inputs, that's going to mean we're going to have more for the future, or use fewer of our resources today, less land, less labor, less fertilizer, what have you. The other consequence, of course, is it produces more food, it drives down prices, and that's good for consumers overall, but it also allows consumers to worry about other things they didn't worry about before. And some of those things that increase productivity, whether it was changes in the way we housed animals or the adoption of biotechnology or any number of things like that, turned out to be things that consumers didn't know about. Happened at the same time consumers were moving away from the farm. And so when consumers realized some of these things were going on in agricultural production, there was a little bit of a backlash there. And so, you know, this is a sort of confluence of issues that are all seem to have been coming together over the last 10, 20 years.
The work of the critics, the antagonists, the Michael Pollans of the world that you mentioned, is it enabled somewhat by the fact that we've got a largely disconnected community of consumers? People, they don't have Grandpa's farm to visit anymore.
It certainly has something to do with it. And the one thing I want to say at the onset is that's not going to change. And so we can bemoan that. And I do think it is a driver of this disconnect, but it's not something that's going to change. So we probably have to accept it at face value. But why does it matter, or how does it matter? Well, one of the reasons it matters is because, you know, back to some of these new technologies we talked about, when people can't understand why they were used or adopted, it's hard for them to get on board. When they can't see the benefits of it, and when the benefits are not obvious to them, think of something like, you know, animal housing conditions. We move poultry and pork production largely indoors these days. And you think about it, you know, why did that happen early on? Well, you know, it's cold and rainy outside, particularly in the winter. So, you know, there's an incentive for producers to move those animals indoors and to protect them from the elements and for predators. And once you did that, you could start thinking about things like better feed and better rations and nutrition and what have you. So there were very logical reasons for the people doing it at the time on the farm. But, you know, a consumer wakes up one day and they're sitting in, you know, New York or Chicago or Dallas or something and say, well, how did all these animals get indoors and they don't have access to outside and they're in cages? But they weren't a part of that process, so it's hard for them to understand how that happens. Same thing with like biotechnology, for example. Oh, you know, we're changing genes around, and the farmers know why they did. They know why they're adopting those technologies. It you know, allows them to control weeds better or to control insects more effectively. Maybe in some cases helps them adopt some no-till technology in the case of herbicide resistance. So the benefit's kind of obvious to the farmer, less obvious to the consumer, particularly in a lot of those cases that I've mentioned just now. The main benefit to the consumer is lower food prices, or food prices that would be, they're lower than what they would have been otherwise. But it's hard for the consumer to connect the dots there. And so there's a lot of wishful thinking on the consumer's behalf. I'm a consumer too, and that, I do that as well. But there sort of seems to be this idea, well, I can have my lower food prices and not use these technologies too. And so that kind of wishful thinking, I think, pervades a lot of these debates as well.
Yeah, just 1 minute here, so a quick answer. Can the farm community change that dynamic? We may not have them able to go back to Grandpa's farm, but can we virtually connect them to the farm. Would that do any good?
I think there are some efforts that have been positive there, and I shouldn't say that. You know, I should have been maybe so pessimistic at the onset there. And there's a lot of efforts to try to, you know, both through social media and conventional media and through a variety of other efforts, try to connect people with farm production. Oh, even some farm bureaus around the country have done a adopt-a-farm kind of model and trying to connect, you know, bloggers or people concerned about the food system with the farmer. And those, from the anecdotes I've seen, can have some impacts there. So I think those things matter. Ultimately, I think what might matter on some of these is the technology itself. When the technologies that are being adopted can be more closely tied with those higher order food values that consumers have, then I think you'll see more widespread adoption.
We'll be back with Jason Lusk right after this.
The choice we make, the choice we make, the choice we make today is gonna stay.
The choice we make,
stay in our life, in our life.
The choice we make.
Back on Town Hall, Ohio, our discussion with food and farm economist Jason Lusk. He's over at Purdue University and joins us today on Town Hall, Ohio. We're talking about some of the disagreements, discord, whatever you want to call it, but different points of view about how we raise food and what that food should look like. Jason, we've talked about the fact that there's a food movement that doesn't think everything is perfect in our food system, and they are actively trying to change it. If I'm a farmer or an agribusiness, you know, I may not like it when somebody blogs something nasty about me, but I'm a big boy, I'll move on. However, it's going to be a whole different story if that that audience of food consumers starts to gain some traction on the legislative and regulatory front. Are we seeing any evidence that people who have alternative views on what food production should look like are starting to make some differences in actual food policy?
I think we do. You know, it's interesting that you asked that, because when I first started writing about some of these food movement issues about 4 or 5 years ago, you know, some of my academic colleagues said, Jason, why are you worrying about these people? You know, they're not really having any impact on food policy. And I think that's rapidly starting to change. So just to give you some examples of that, you know, we saw ballot initiatives across the country related to mandatory labeling for genetically engineered foods. It was about 5 or 6 different states that where those ballot initiatives were held. Ultimately, we had a state legislature in Vermont that passed a law, which then prompted a federal law. So I think that's an outgrowth of a food movement. Another example of ballot initiatives that have been held in several states are related to animal housing conditions. I know you've had some of that in Ohio, also at the state legislative level in ballot initiatives in places like California and Arizona and others. We have votes on issues related to soda taxes in a variety of both counties and states. And so I think these are all outgrowths of the food movement. They, you know, thus far haven't been nearly as successful in affecting federal legislation, so they've sort of resorted to these other means of getting the kind of outcomes they want. But I think what we're starting to see now is that several folks are making calls for changes in food policy. We have people like Michael Pollan and some of his co-authors explicitly coming out asking for a new, you know, food policy rather than a farm policy, even writing papers asking for a new government agency called the Department of Food or something along those lines to replace the USDA or FDA. So, yes, are they having that much impact in terms of, say, affecting the farm bill? Not quite yet. But I think we're starting to see evidence that they're starting to have more impact there than they once did.
I think it's also true, maybe you'll agree and can comment, that they're also having more influence on the food industry. Farmers may argue that farrowing crates are not such a bad, their gestation stalls are not such a bad thing, but the consumer says we don't like them, and Smithfield or whoever says, okay, producers, you can't use them anymore. This consumer food movement seems to be having an influence on the food industry.
well, it's certainly the case that they are, and you can see it in the number of farm-to-table restaurants we have out there today. That is another piece of evidence of the outgrowth of the impact of the food movement. You can certainly see that, and some of that is, I think, a healthy outcome of a well-functioning market economy where if people want new things and they're willing to pay for them and they can convince somebody to sell it to them, that, you know, that's a great part of what makes a dynamic marketplace. But, you know, when we then start talking about public policy, for example, I think that's where we might want to think a little more critically about costs and benefits for everybody that's being affected there.
One more thing on the commercial side of thing. You say it's a sign of a good, healthy marketplace, but also leads to signs on a milk jug that say GMO free.
Right. Well, there is a lot of confusion as well, and I think that is one challenge that it is easy to scare people with absence claims when there's not a lot of science behind it. I'm frankly not all that sure what should be done about that. I would be a little reluctant to say, you know, we're not going to allow you to make certain claims if you want that. But, you know, if you're making claims that are scientifically accurate, I think that is a challenge. I'm not exactly sure what to do about that, but particularly if you're making claims that tend to suggest that there's some evidence of health or a food safety risk when in fact they're not, that can be problematic, I think.
I've got about 30 seconds here, so make this a quick answer if you would, please. You'd mentioned that localities and states are now stepping in to make food policies where the federal government hasn't. Is that a good idea when food policy isn't national?
I think it presents a real challenge for food companies that are working across state and local lines, because then they have tens, if not hundreds, of different rules that they have to comply with, that which ultimately might make our food costly. So ultimately, if we can have trust in our food system, and we can have a basic set of laws that food companies can correspond to, we'll have many fewer transactions, costs, and I think a more abundant and more affordable food supply.
We will be back in just a couple of moments to continue our conversation with Dr. Jason Lusk, distinguished professor and head of the Department of Agricultural Economics at Purdue University. Jason Lusk will return right after this on Town Hall, Ohio.
Everything I take so personally, 'cause I just can't see through rationality.
How we think about our food, how we think about how it's produced, and how differences of opinion can be good or sometimes not so good for the food economy. That's our topic today with Dr. Jason Lusk, food and farm economist from Purdue University. Jason, we've spent a lot of time kind of spelling out the differences of viewpoints and who holds what opinion. So on the assumption that finding common ground between differing views is a good thing, where do we start? How do we start to resolve some of these sometimes consequential differences of opinion?
I think there's a variety of ways to think about that. One is, I think, to accept the premise of some of the food movement arguments, which is we care about the environment, we care about human health, and, you know, sort of agreeing that we have some values that we share in common, I think, is a good starting point. And then we can start asking questions like, well, are the things you're proposing versus, let's say, the things I'm proposing going to have a better impact on the environment or on human health? And then it's a more productive conversation, because we've agreed at the onset neither one of us is evil. And then it's really more of a question about how are we going to achieve those kind of things. And so that's one useful way to start framing some of these discussions. And I think you referred to the piece I wrote recently where I was critical a lot of the policy proposals of the food movement. And I think that's what I'm trying to do there, is to try to point out that a lot of the specific policies they're proposing probably aren't going to have much of an impact on human health or environment, at least not in a cost-effective way.
Well, let me jump in there, Jason. Go ahead and list maybe a couple of those where it might sound like a good idea, but probably isn't really.
So it's kind of hard to know where to start because there's so many of them. But just to give you one example, you know, the food movement folks are very critical of our you know, sort of commodity support programs that we have today in agriculture. And they have some good economic reasons to be somewhat critical of those. I think most economists would agree with that. But at the same time, they seem to associate those commodity support programs with everything bad that they see in modern agriculture. And they seem to have this idea that if we just got rid of those, we wouldn't have, you know, animal agriculture, for example, in confined feeding operations. We wouldn't have, you know, really high rates of diabetes. We would have more affordable fruits and vegetables. And I think, you know, by and large, it's just not true. Those policies just don't have that big of an effect. And moreover, it's not just that they want to get rid of those. They want to re-engineer them in a way that, for example, adds subsidies to, say, fruits and vegetables, or only allocates them to certain kinds of farms that are doing the farm practices they like. And, you know, those might redistribute monies to the people they would prefer, but it's really unclear to me that they're going to actually produce many meaningful benefits. In the case of fruits and vegetables, often these are large producers already operating under some form of contracting, so they're protecting their risk in other ways. And we're talking about, when we talk about things like water use, pesticide use, fertilizer use, those tend to be fairly high in fruit and vegetable production compared to commodity agriculture production. So I think a lot of it does just stem back to this lack of a basic understanding of why we produce a lot of commodity crops. The reason we produce a lot of corn and soybeans and wheat and rice is because these are the plants that nature and humans, through selection, are able to convert sunlight energy into energy in the form of seeds in a highly productive way. And they put that edible energy in a seed that can be easily stored and easily transported. That's the reason we produce a lot of these crops, not because there's some, you know, bad government policy, there's some corporate conspiracy. And so I think, just understanding that basic underlying biology and physics is really important to understanding why our food system is the way it is, and the challenge of moving it away from the way it is to something different.
I know you've got some books out there. Maybe throw a title or three out that folks might find of some interest if they go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever.
Sure. Well, thanks for the opportunity to do a little promotion here. My first major popular book was a book called The Food Police, and that came out in 2013. That's a somewhat argumentative book where I really take the food movement on, and particularly its policy proposals. And in that book, I also talk about specific issues, you know, related to organics and local foods and obesity and biotechnology, and really contrast the food movement's perspective with what I think is the best science available. My newest book came out in the spring of 2016, and it's called Unnaturally Delicious. And in that book, what I'm trying to do is tell the stories of ag and food innovation through the eyes of innovators and the eyes of scientists developing those technologies to really solve the world's problems, and trying to work a little bit on this connected values that I mentioned before, that if we really want to make headways on the environment, who are the people doing that? What are the kind of agricultural technologies they're adopting and using? And so in that book, I'm trying to engender a little bit of excitement for innovation and technology.
We'll be back to wrap up our visit with Jason Lusk in a moment.
Urban folks now love organic meat.
Welcome back to Town Hall, Ohio. We're visiting with food and farm economist Jason Lusk from Purdue University. And Jason is making the case today that while there are a lot of well-intentioned people trying to establish food policy, sometimes those intentions end up with unintended consequences. Jason, one of the big things that has come up in recent years, especially at the local level, are governments that want to employ a fat tax. In other words, making it economically difficult to buy, well, I guess, large, supersized sodas and such. Talk a little bit about where that concept came from and whether it's working.
It's actually the idea of a soda tax originated over 20 years ago in an editorial in the New York Times. It might have been around before that, but that's...
Why does that not surprise me?
Right. I think it's another example of where really ideas matter, and it's important to take them seriously because they eventually, have real-world impact at times. And so the fat tax basically just refers to the idea of trying to make, quote-unquote, unhealthy foods more expensive and, quote-unquote, healthy foods less expensive. And the reason I say quote is because, you know, what exactly is a healthy or unhealthy food? And that's, in practice, turns out to be a real challenge. The real-world sort of implementation of a lot of these is focused on things like sodas and trying to implement a soda tax. And, you know, if your goal is to reduce soda consumption, making them more expensive will likely cause people to consume fewer of them. And I think the question, though, is it really going to have any meaningful impact on obesity or on human health? And I think the evidence there is much less certain. And the reason is there are a lot of substitutes for soda. So if you make sodas more expensive, what am I going to substitute towards? And there are several studies out there. I may substitute towards things like milk or fruit juices, or there's even one study that suggests people might substitute to things like beer. All those things also have calories. And so what we care about is if we're caring about things like obesity, is what are the total caloric intake, what's the change in vitamins and nutrients. And so it's not like people just don't respond to the policy. They substitute and eat different things. And so there's a real disconnect, I think, between the kinds of studies that get done. You have a lot of epidemiologists that say, well, people will consume fewer sodas, and they then apply that to all these models and say you'll have X fewer deaths and this much less obesity. But in the cases where these have actually been implemented in the real world, it's been really hard for researchers to actually find that they actually do anything meaningful in the real world. And I think so part of the challenge there is that, you know, again, people have options and they'll substitute to things that may have alternative consequences. I think the real negative impacts of things like a soda tax or just sort of the quote-unquote junk food tax in general is that the burden of those taxes primarily fall on lower-income households. And that's particularly problematic because lower-income households already spend a higher portion of their budget on food. And so those taxes are being borne by those people in society who can least afford to pay it. In the parlance of economics, we'd say it's a very regressive form of tax. And not only that, some other research that I've done suggests that we just want to make healthy foods more affordable, so we're going to subsidize things like fruits and vegetables. Well, who's already eating fruits and vegetables? It turns out the people eating those in the highest volumes are already people that are relatively well off. So you're basically subsidizing people who can already afford to pay the prices for fruits and vegetables. And so it's a very regressive sort of policy. And I'm not saying the impacts are going to be zero. I'm just saying that the best evidence we have suggests that the evidence is that they're just going to have really small impacts on what people are eating. But the economic consequences are that probably the burden of these policies is primarily going to fall on the poor households. So that's really my concern with the policies. But ultimately, at the end of the day, my biggest take home for people is it's just not going to have that much impact one way or the other. That it's a policy that often gets pitched as solving some kind of problem when, in fact, you know, it will likely have just very minimal impacts one way or the other.
Jason Lusk, our guest today, a very interesting take on what's going on in the world of the food movement, agriculture, and ultimately food policy. Dr. Jason Lusk is Distinguished Professor and Head of the Department of Agricultural Economics at Purdue University, author, and just Google Jason Lusk and you'll be able to find his homepage and many of his writings. Thanks for joining us today on Town Hall, Ohio.
Town Hall, Ohio is a project of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation and is brought to you with the support of Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Join us again next week for Town Hall, Ohio.